From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. We're just 6 days away from the big election. Many voters have already sent in their ballots, others looking forward to going to the polls next Tuesday. But always plenty of questions about how our votes are counted, what happens to ballots with errors or unmatched signatures. We'll get answers from the registrars of L.A. and Orange counties right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. What a pleasure to have you with us today. Just want to remind you, election night next Tuesday, I'll be here along with NPR's continuing coverage. Libby Denkman joins me, and we have the pleasure of bringing you all the live returns from throughout Southern California, the statewide races, the ballot propositions, and of course, NPR with its coverage out of Washington on the very latest of the congressional races. Will Democrats flip the House of Representatives? What will happen to the Republican majority in the Senate? Those and all the statewide and local issues and races. That's Tuesday night. Our coverage begins as a part of All Things Considered Tuesday afternoon, November 6th, right here on 89.3, as Nick Roman will get us started on that. Also want to remind you that the day after the election, I will be hosting a statewide call-in program on public radio stations throughout California. We'll be heard in San Francisco on KQED, San Diego on KPBS, throughout the Central Valley on stations in Bakersfield and Fresno, Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. All will be carrying our live statewide programming originating right here at KPCC. That'll be the day after the election, 11 o'clock, a week from today, right here on KPCC and statewide. So please tell your friends who are elsewhere in California. Coming up later this hour, the practice of paying protesters. How do we know that members of a crowd have shown up because of personal convictions instead of compensation? But first, voting by mail is underway, as well as early voting in specific locations in Southern California. For many of us, we look forward to the old-fashioned Election Day visit to our local polling place. With all the attention on challenges the voters have had in other states, we thought we'd look at what local voters need to know to make sure that our ballots are tabulated. We're very pleased to have with us the registrars of Los Angeles County, Dean Logan, and Orange County, Neil Kelly. Gentlemen, a pleasure to have you both with us. Neil, let me start with you and find out in Orange County, what sort of changes, if any, are in place for this election versus what happened a couple of years ago in November?
Well, Larry, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. There's quite a few changes. Some of the things that we've done have been focused on physical security as well as the cybersecurity. And we've worked closely with Homeland Security and the FBI on beefing up our defenses over the last 2 years. So definitely a lot happening on more behind the scenes, really not noticeable so much to the voters, but definitely a much more higher profile security posture.
And what do you use for your actual polling locations on voting day? What kind of technology do you employ?
So we use what's called Hardiner Civic, which is it's not a touchscreen device, but it is an electronic voting booth with a paper backup inside of that. And voters that go to polling places also have the option to select a regular paper ballot.
And what percentage of Orange County voters do you anticipate will vote by mail or drop off a ballot at a polling location as opposed to using the in-polling place technology?
So what's been really interesting over the last couple of weeks is our vote by mail turnout. When you look back to the presidential election in 2016, we're about 30% behind that mark. But when you compare it to 2014, we're about 30% ahead of that mark. So definitely a lot of interest in this midterm that we didn't see a few years ago. I would expect, Larry, that we're going to see about 60-plus percent in Orange County vote by mail. at the end of the day.
All right. And is there any difference in party registration as to who votes by mail?
Well, I mean, early vote-by-mail users tend to skew Republican. As you get a little closer to Election Day, that tends to skew Democrat. But I think all bets are off with this midterm, to be honest with you, because we're seeing some changes in the vote-by-mail returns in terms of demographics. More young people are using vote-by-mail this cycle. So it's hard to predict, but that's generally what you see.
And that's interesting because, as you said, historically, Republicans have been thought of as the earlier vote-by-mail folks, and you're seeing such an early turnout. One could think if you look at it historically, well, maybe that's good news for Republicans. But as you say, if the demographics are showing more younger voters in that mix, then you wouldn't necessarily be seeing that historic pattern.
That's correct, and that's part of the conundrum that I think we're in right now and trying to analyze it.
All right. Neil Kelly, Registrar of Voters in Orange County, also with us, Dean Logan of L.A. County. Dean, what if any changes are we going to be seeing at our L.A. County polling locations?
Great to be with you, Larry, and thanks for having us on. So here in L.A. County, if you look at it, changes that have taken place since the November 16 presidential election, our focus here has really been on the voter experience and what voters see when they interact with the process. So the biggest change in L.A. County was that we introduced a new vote-by-mail ballot in this election. So the vote-by-mail ballot is more intuitive. It's easier for voters to mark. It's easier for them to understand and easier for them to return. In this particular election, first time in L.A. County, the postage is paid on those return vote-by-mail ballots. So we've seen a steady increase in voters opting to vote those ballots. We've also expanded our early voting program. So we had early voting that started last weekend in L.A. County. That will continue this weekend at 10 locations throughout the county from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. We had a good turnout at those locations last weekend. And then at the polling places on Election Day, while the voting experience remains the same in L.A. County as it was in 2016, we've beefed up our As Neil had indicated, in Orange County, we've beefed up our security mechanisms, our training of poll workers, and the resources that are available to voters at those locations. So we see a large percentage of our mail-in voters who prefer still to take that ballot in and drop it off either at a polling place on Election Day, or we have over 150 ballot drop-off locations throughout the county to kind of appeal to that voter who likes to receive the ballot through the mail but still wants to put it into a ballot box once they've marked that ballot.
As challenging as election days are for your office back in June, you had a particularly rough day with over 100,000 registered voters who were accidentally left off the rosters at polling locations. And of course, they were still able to vote with provisional ballots and to have their votes counted. Some people, though, said they were told, well, they weren't registered. They couldn't vote, were given improper information, they said. What was the upshot of that? What caused the problem? And what fixes have been put in place to try and avoid that?
Sure. That was obviously a significant issue in June and one that we take very seriously. It turned out that was a data compatibility issue between our local election management system that produces those rosters and the way it interacts with the new statewide voter registration database. We've addressed that through some tried to address the compatibility issue of those systems, but more importantly, through our quality assurance mechanisms and just basically pouring through that data and doing a better job of checking all of the data fields. It was sort of an innocuous issue that resulted in that in June. So that's been addressed. As you pointed out, though, I think it's always important, especially a week out before the election, conducting an election in any jurisdiction is a major undertaking, and we still rely on really manual processes and a distributed method of delivering service. We have over 25,000 poll workers out there at 4,000 voting locations. So it's important that we have backup plans, and that really is what the provisional ballot is for in California. That sometimes gets confusing in national media because other states have different rules, more restrictive rules about provisional voting, but it really is the fail-safe method in California. So while that issue in June resulted in about 12,000 voters who had to vote provisional ballots that were ultimately counted in the election. We don't expect that to happen on Tuesday, but we want voters to know that they won't be turned away from a polling place. So any issue that they're experiencing on election day, we have a backup plan to address.
So, and really important to stress. So even if one of the volunteer poll workers gives you an indication, you can't, just remember you have the right to cast a provisional ballot. It will be counted once they confirm that you are on the voter rolls, and all of those are counted. There's another sort of myth that, well, if there aren't enough provisional ballots that would switch, a particular election, that they would not be counted. That is not true. And Dean, I'll let you reinforce that. But you, once it's verified, you count every provisional, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And, it's funny, and I think Neil would say the same thing. We are always surprised every year to hear that myth repeated, that and actually we hear that even with regard to vote-by-mail ballots, that people say, well, we don't think you count those unless there's a close contest. Nothing could be further from the truth. We in California have, an elongated post-election canvass period that ensures that every valid vote is counted in the election, provides for auditing and accountability of that. And while that is agonizing for candidates and sometimes for the media, it really is that mechanism that guarantees for all of our voters that if you show up and cast your vote and have your voice heard on election day, we're going to make sure that vote is included in the final returns of this election.
We're talking with Dean Logan, the Registrar of Los Angeles County, Neil Kelly, the Orange County Registrar, and I'd like to hear from you. Any questions you have about early voting, voting by mail, any questions you might have based on previous experiences voting at your local polling place, please give us a call. Both gentlemen would be glad to answer your questions. Even if you're not a registered voter in one of these two counties, if they're more generalized kinds of election questions, either Neil or Dean should be able to answer them if they're more generalized and not specific to a given county. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-KPECC. 5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Pippi writes on the page, for voting by mail, if I make a mistake on that vote by mail ballot, putting a yes, for example, when I meant it to be a no, do I have to get a new ballot or can I white out the line and correct it? Pippi wondering. Neil Kelly of Orange County, how should she deal with that?
That's a great question. At this stage in the game, because we're closer to Election Day, I would encourage her to, she can circle what her answer would be and make a clear X mark on the one that she does not want. She can use her initials if she wanted to. She can use an arrow to indicate that. That's all allowed in state law, and we have a mechanism in place to handle that. We duplicate that ballot, and we can record the correct results. If she's still concerned, she can always go to one of our early vote centers if she's an Orange County voter. Or she could go to a polling place on election day and vote provisionally. But I don't want to discourage people because we see this all the time, Larry, where people have made mistakes on ballots. They make the correction and we handle it with a procedure in our office.
Okay, very good. And if someone was given a vote by mail ballot and they got preoccupied, didn't fill it out or whatever, can they still go vote at their local polling place and just destroy the vote-by-mail ballot? Or do they have to turn in that vote-by-mail ballot at the local polling place? Does that become the only way to cast their ballot?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because if they bring that ballot with them, it will avoid an additional check-in procedure for them. So it saves time, not only for us, but for the voter, more importantly. So bring that ballot with them to the polling place is my recommendation. If they have happened to thrown it away or destroyed it, they can certainly come in, but then they go through the provisional process.
Okay. Dean, did you want to add anything to that?
I think it's funny. I was going to start exactly where Neil did and say, I'm so glad that you asked that question, because I think it's important for voters to know that that's a rule in California election law called the surrender, that gets referred to as the surrender rule. So if you did make a mistake and choose to go to the polling place or just decided that you don't want to use the vote by mail ballot and want to vote at the polling place, best bet is to bring in that vote-by-mail ballot and surrender. And just as Neil said, you'll be able to vote a regular ballot. At the same time, we don't want to discourage people from voting. If you don't have the vote-by-mail ballot or you forget to take it with you, we're gonna be sure you get to vote. You're just going to have to go through that provisional ballot process.
This somewhat related. Diane in Hawthorne called, since she's L.A. County. I'll ask you, Dean. She said, I was sent a ballot to vote by mail. I don't remember requesting it. I'd prefer to go in and cast my vote. Can I still do that? So in that case, Dean, does Diane need to take in that vote by mail ballot?
We would encourage her to do that. Again, that will allow her to just sign in and vote a regular ballot, which it sounds like is what she wishes to do. But again, if she has the option either way, if she doesn't have it with her, she can still go to that polling place. They're just going to issue her a provisional ballot. And the other thing I would say to her is that we can certainly provide her, if she gets in touch with us, we can provide her with the information on how she got listed as a vote-by-mail voter, and if she wishes to have that removed, we're happy to accommodate that as well.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. It's your chance to talk with the gentleman at the top of the whole voting procedures for their respective counties, Los Angeles and Orange Counties, Dean Logan, Neil Kelly, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Some of this is so complex. Once I finish talking with him in our segment, I always think, oh, why didn't I ask him about that? Why didn't? So you can help backstop me and ask the questions that I'm not thinking of that you think are important. 866-893-KPECC. Angela in the Miracle Mile says, I have a mail-in ballot, sealed my envelope, realized I didn't put it in a privacy sleeve. I wonder, would that mistake keep my vote from being counted? Neil Kelly, how do you deal with that?
So we don't have a privacy sleeve in Orange County, so there would be an issue with that.
Okay.
It was directly in the envelope, and it's fine.
Dean, what about for L.A. County voters?
So in L.A. County, with the new vote-by-mail ballot, because it is multiple pages, we did provide a secrecy sleeve for the voter to put their ballots in. It is not a requirement. It's there to provide that sense of security and secrecy and to be sure that they get all those pages back into the ballot. However, in the situation that this voter is talking about, that is not going to affect the way their ballot is processed. If the ballots are in that envelope, they're going to be counted.
All right. Efren in Whittier, good to have you with us on Air Talk. Your question, sir.
Yeah, I haven't voted in a number of years, and I haven't registered, and I was wondering if I'm still able to go to my local polling place and cast a ballot at all.
Okay. You're in Whittier, so Dean, I'll ask you that. How should he handle this?
Yeah, no, a great question, and I also live in Whittier, so it's great to hear you.
Your neighbor.
There are a couple things. First, I would encourage you to go on our website at lavote.net and confirm your registration. You can put in some data, and it will confirm that you are or are not registered to vote, and will give you the information about where to vote on election day. If for some reason you are not listed as a registered voter, it is not too late. You can go to any of the early voting locations this weekend, and you can still register to vote and vote on location this weekend, or you can do that at our Norwalk headquarters all the way through Election Day. Now, you can't do that on Election Day at a polling place, but you can do that at the early voting sites or here at our headquarters.
Okay, so Efren, it sounds like you don't want to wait till Election Day to confirm that whether you're registered or not, because you would be shut out if you show up at the polling place Election Day and you're not registered to vote. So we wish you the best. With that, let's talk with Inglewood resident Matthew. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, I'm just calling as a first-time voter by mail. I sent in my request for a mail ballot last week, but I haven't yet received the vote-by-mail ballot. So I'm just curious if I should have, or kind of what the regular time frames are to receive the ballots.
Dean?
Yeah, so if you sent that in last week, the chances are that we received that request and have processed it and your ballot is in transit to you. We are noticing this year, and this is a trend that started in 2016, that the turnaround time for even for first-class mail is taking longer than it used to. So if you just applied last week, My best estimate is that your ballot is still on its way to you. Again, if you want to get in touch with us directly, either through social media or through our phone line, we can double check that. We actually can go in and see from our mail processor when that hit the mail stream and when it's estimated to be received by you. But if it was a week ago, I think you're still in good shape and that ballot should get there in the next couple of days.
And if it doesn't, again, because Matthew is a registered voter, if for some reason it's lost in the mail, whatever, he can still go on Election Day, correct, cast the provisional ballot and it'll be counted.
Absolutely. Either Election Day or even this weekend at any of the early voting locations.
All right. All right. Very good. Julie writes on the page, it works. I lost my mail-in ballot during the midterm primary, so I voted in person at my polling place using a provisional ballot. The extra procedure took maybe 5 minutes. A few days after the election, I received a certification that my vote had been counted. That's Julie. Hawkeye writes on the AirTalk page, a resident of Santa Clarita did not receive a ballot and registered online after the October cutoff date. Can he use a conditional ballot or cast a conditional ballot at the Santa Clarita satellite offices for early voting, or would the voter need to go to the main office in Norwalk on voting day? Dean Logan?
Yeah, so if they miss the October 22nd deadline, they can still register and vote at any of the early voting sites. So there isn't one in Santa Clarita. There is one at the Lancaster Public Library that'll be open Saturday and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Or on our website, any of the 10 locations that are available, that person would be able to register and vote.
Star in Santa Monica says, I'm a naturalized citizen, registered to vote, but my real ID is held up at INS because I had a name change. I've had a temporary license since May. Am I really registered to vote, or would I likely be off the list? Neil, do you want to speak to that issue because of the real ID problem?
Yeah, I would say more than likely she would be on the list, Larry, but I would encourage her to go on to the website of the Secretary of State and just to verify her registration. It just takes a few minutes to do that. The real ID issue has been a problem. We have worked closely with DMV and the Secretary of State on that, so I'm encouraging any voters in that position to verify their registration as soon as they can.
All right. And Angie wonders, is it possible to confirm receipt of a mailed-in ballot? Neil, how do you or do you let people know you've received it?
Yes, we do. We have a program called OC Ballot Express, and they can track their ballot from the moment it's printed all the way through the mail stream and then all the way back to us. And they can sign up for that on our website, and they'll send them text messages along the way, just like FedEx does, for instance, on a package.
All right. Okay, gentlemen, we've had so many calls. I know you're incredibly busy 6 days before election. I hate to put you on the spot on the air, but Neil, could you stay about 9 more minutes?
Of course, sure.
Thank you. Dean, can you possibly stay about 9 more?
Sure, happy to do it.
All right, I'm sorry to put you on the spot live like that, but we have a lot of calls, and these are good questions. We'll continue our conversation with the registrars of Orange and Los Angeles County, Neil Kelly and Dean Logan, respectively. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Your chance to ask the folks that are at the top running the election systems in two of the largest counties in the United States. We'll be back in 1 minute. Appreciate our busy registrars of Los Angeles, Orange County, staying a few more minutes here so we can take a few more listener calls. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dean Logan, Los Angeles County Registrar Recorder. Does L.A. County have the kind of tracking system that Neil Kelly just talked about in Orange County?
We do have a tracking system for vote-by-mail ballots. It is not as elaborate as what Neil has in Orange County, but we do have the ability, if you go on our website at lavote.net, you can track that ballot. In particular, you can track to make sure that we got your voted ballot back here and that it has been processed and counted.
All right. Let's see. Andrea in Woodland Hills asks, if someone is leaving town, still hasn't received their vote-by-mail ballot, is anyone else allowed to fill out their ballot on their behalf? That's Andrea in Woodland Hills. Dean?
So So no, you cannot have a proxy ballot. The ballot does need to be filled out by the voter, and the envelope has to be signed by the voter in order for that to be valid. So the options that would be available would be to contact us. We can again track to see where that ballot is in the process, and we can work with you on options to make sure that we can get you that ballot before you leave town. Or if you're still in town this weekend, you could go to one of the early voting locations.
All right. Speaking of the early voting locations, and this is the move that counties are making throughout the state, that in the future there will not be the neighborhood polling places, but instead sort of super voting centers where people could, and they wouldn't be required to vote at a specific location. They could vote close to where they work, et cetera. How close are we, Dean, to having that take place in L.A. County?
So L.A. County plans to move to that model in 2020. So we plan to roll that out in the March 2020 presidential primary election, and that will be augmented with vote by mail. I think you described it very well, Larry. I think it's important for people to know that that's actually an expansion of access to voting. So voting will actually be available at these vote centers over an 11-day period. We'll start opening vote centers 10 days before the election. As we get to the weekend before the election, we'll open even more of those centers. And we are working right now through public meetings and with community partners to identify where the best locations are going to be for these vote centers to make them places that are relevant to the electorate. So they're places. Our philosophy is meeting people where they are. So it's not intended to be something where it'll be difficult for the voter to find voting. It's actually going to be making voting visible and available to people where they're out and about and participating in other activities.
Parking, please make sure there's plenty of parking because, I mean, there might be locations where you'll have a lot of walk-in because of a high concentration of businesses, but it's going to be so important to make it accessible that people have a reasonable place that they can park.
No, that's so true, and I think that accessibility is a big part of the drive to move to this new model because whether it be parking, whether it be the accessibility features of the actual physical building, and even the accessible features of the voting equipment that will be in those voting locations, those are all important considerations that have been part of the design of this new model.
Robin Mid-Wilshire, good to have you with us. You have a question about signatures, I understand.
Yeah, it's been so long ago that I registered to vote. I'm not sure how I signed my name. You go to the ballot, you go to the polling station, not a problem. They look at the book, you sign, you're on your way. With vote by mail, you know, I'm kind of wondering, how do you go and confirm the voter signature? And also, you know, as people get older, their signature tends to change.
No, it's a really good point. This has been highly controversial in Georgia, where one of the counties, I believe it is, have disqualified quite a few of the vote-by-mail ballots because they said the signatures didn't match. And so the concern, you know, of voting rights advocates has been that, you know, are the people that are doing the comparison, are they properly trained? Can they see some of the changes that would come by age? You know, what criteria are used to do the signature matching? So, Neil Kelly in Orange County, how do you do it there?
So we do have an extensive training program, Larry, and the caller is right on point because I sign my credit card statement now and it looks very different from my voter registration form, very different. But, you know, the legislature saw this as well and has recently passed a bill and the governor signed it. And it's in effect for this election now, which means that if your signature does not match, we cannot match up any point on the signature, we are required to send you a letter, and you have an opportunity to cure that by signing a form and indicating, yes, this is me, you mail that back to us, and then your ballot would count. So this is a really good thing for this election, and I think will vastly improve that issue.
Okay, so you don't even, it's not like you even have to work to match it. You'll let the person know, as long as they attest, yes, that is my signature, it's me, then you'll count the ballot.
That's correct.
Okay, very, very good. Let's see. Jeffrey in Beverly Hills says, if you have a vote-by-mail ballot, but you do want to drop it off at your polling place on election day, do you have to wait through the long line of people waiting to cast their votes, or can you just go up to the front of the line and drop off your vote-by-mail ballot? Dean?
Great question. No, you do not need to wait in line. You can take that directly to the table, and the poll worker will direct you to the ballot box. And again, want to emphasize that in addition to the polling places on Election Day, we have 150 locations throughout the county where you could drop off that ballot any day leading up to the election and on Election Day. And you can find those locations, again, on our website at lavote.net.
All right. Quick question. Cydia in Whittier says, both my mother and I do mail-in ballots. We fill them out together. She lives in Los Angeles. I live in Whittier. Why are the order of the candidates swapped? Our ballots look so different. Neil?
Well, that's a great question. There's something in California called rotations. And what happens is that candidates rotate on the ballot depending on what location you're in by assembly district. We have one of the most complex rotation laws in the country, and building and designing a ballot, you can see the complexity of that and the reason for that. But that's exactly what.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much. Really appreciate your spending all this time with us today on Air Talk as you're getting your counties all prepped for Election Day and handling the vote-by-mail ballots. That's Neil Kelly, Orange County's Registrar of Voters, Dean Logan, the Registrar Recorder and County Clerk for Los Angeles. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We have much more to come right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. I'm a sucker for spooky stuff on the radio. You know, there are times I'll seek out on satellite radio the radio classics and listen to some of, you know, Inner Sanctum and stuff like that. Well, tonight we've got our version of spooky Halloween radio here on KPCC. Brand new programming, 4 hours of ghost stories. At 8 o'clock, we broadcast Spooked. Stories of the supernatural told by the people who say it happened to them. And the stories collected by the producers of Snap Judgment. So keep your door locked, the radio on, Spooked, tonight at 8 o'clock here on 89.3 KPCC. Well, you might have heard President Trump talk about paid protesters, people who were compensated for coming out and protesting against his policies or his administration. That is you know, one claim that's been made about paid protesters. But there is, in fact, such a phenomenon of protesters being paid to come out. Businesses have often used them. People have been recruited to come out and be compensated to protest at city council meetings. How common is this? And what are the ways that we, the public, can try and determine whether someone is, you know, truly believing in a cause that they're supporting or compensated? With us is Los Angeles Times reporter James Rufus Corum, who wrote a recent article about paid protesters, including a Beverly Hills company that is accused of extortion in a lawsuit, a company that hires people to come out and protest. James, thank you for joining us.
Sure thing, Larry. Good to be here.
So share with us what this Beverly Hills company does. What's his business model for hiring people?
Sure. It appears to advertise on Facebook, Backstage, which does kind of casting calls for extras, and it very openly is in the business of hiring people to go to rallies, go to protests. I think really it started out hiring people to act like fake paparazzi or fake kind of, you know, hordes of fans looking to, you know, looking to cheer people on as they roam the streets of L.A. But they're very open about hiring people to show up and pay to be protest attendees or rally attendees.
And just briefly, what's the claim in this lawsuit about the practices of the company?
Sure. It's not about even the practices necessarily. The claim is that Krauss-Unwin was hired by a hedge fund manager in Prague to hector and go after a Czech investor who lives here in the U.S., with the idea being that if they, you know, they send people to his house in South Carolina and call U.S. outfits that he's affiliated with, like Dartmouth College and the Aspen Institute, that this guy in Prague could extort money out of him. That's the claim.
That's the
claim.
So that Krauss-Unwin
demand is being used as a tool to extort money out of him.
And this company very openly advertises for people to be hired to come out and protest, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look on Backstage, you can find ads from them. I think there may have been Craigslist ads and Facebook ads as well, but they are very open about what they do.
I'd love to hear from you, if you're an AirTalk listener who's ever been hired to come out to a city council meeting, to a public protest. If you're someone who's actually answered an ad for that and done it, I'd be interested in what your experience of that was. 866-893-KPCC. And were you side by side with people who were actual believers in the specific cause, or were pretty much all like you, people who were hired to come out to the event? 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, a gentleman who has studied the phenomenon. He's professor of sociology at UCLA, Edward Walker. Professor Walker's book is titled Grassroots for Hire, Public Affairs Consultants in American Democracy. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
So what's the history of this so-called astroturfing as opposed to grassroots? I love that term. How far back does this go?
You know, it actually goes back to Senator Lloyd Bentsen in the mid-80s, who was on the receiving end of a deluge of letters coming from apparently independent citizens, but was actually being funded by the insurance industry. And he was the one who said, well, this looks a whole lot like grassroots, but in fact, it's really astroturf. And that sort of became a term of art in the field. And it is, in fact, a real phenomenon. One thing to say up front is I think it's important, you know, not to conclude that paid protesting is a very widespread tactic. I mean, we're hearing a lot of conspiracy theories out there about the role of George Soros today. In some ways, this is an echo of some of the things that we heard during the civil rights era, you know, this sort of dog whistle about communism, about outside agitators being the ones who are driving the activity. I would say it's a relatively risky strategy in many ways, and so a lot of advocacy groups tend to avoid this. But at the same time, the effort to mobilize the mass public in political activity in a variety of forms is – that part itself is widespread. But I would say it's primarily a tactic used by corporations and industry groups. Firms and industry groups tend to be better at engaging in the marketplace than they are at mobilizing people like a social movement group would do. And so when these firms need a showing of mass support, you know, they're not often in a position to carry it out themselves. And so they outsource a lot of this activity. They outsource it to firms like Crowds on Demand, although I would say Crowds on Demand is a little bit unusual in this field. But there is a whole field of professional grassroots lobbying firms, sometimes called public affairs consultants, that they know how to get people involved. By my estimates, something like 40% of the Fortune 500 companies are showing up on the client list of at least one of these firms.
Wow, 40.
So it's relatively widespread.
That is what, and are there typical ways in which they're used?
You know, it's I would say a wide range of things. So sometimes it's getting people to turn out to lobbying days where they, you know, will get people to fly into Washington or Sacramento to make their case. Sometimes it's through advocacy advertisements. Actually, President Trump, in his prior work as a casino magnate, had hired a firm, actually Roger Stone and Paul Manafort's firm, as it turns out, who was one of these firms early on, to do exactly that, to hire them to do advocacy advertisements to help them make their case to push back against a competing Native American casino interest. So the practice is relatively widespread, and it covers a lot of different practices.
We're talking with Edward Walker, UCLA professor of sociology, author of a book that came out just a few years ago, Grassroots for Hire, Public Affairs Consultants in American Democracy. Also with us, longtime California Democratic political consultant, Gary South. Gary, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be with you.
And I'm curious how often we see this in the political world. You know, I think, for example, the huge women's marches that we had across the country with, you know, just enormous here in Los Angeles, I think was the biggest in the country. Obviously, these are people with day jobs. They come out on a Saturday and care very deeply about the issues of concern. But sometimes I do wonder, you look at like protesters out in the middle of the day for some of these things. How many of these are legit or not?
Well, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, just to be absolutely clear, you know, campaigns have been paying people to do things for decades, maybe centuries even. But what concerns me about this is the commercialization of this whole process. You know, it just all adds to the growing sense of unreality in political campaigns, the feeling that you can't even believe your own two eyes. I mean, photoshopping has made it easy as pie to doctor photographs, so you can phony up a picture of your opponent standing next to Hitler or the Wicked Witch of the West. We know much of the traffic on social media is being driven by bots or by Russians sitting in St. Petersburg, paid by Putin's chef to steal the identities of Americans to post on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Wired magazine yesterday just published a report that 60% of the traffic on Twitter about the so-called caravan that Trump says is about to invade the U.S. is actually driven by bots. And so to get to the point where you can't even believe your eyes that the people at a political event or rally or protest are really there because they support the candidate, it's troubling. And speaking of Trump, it's been documented that Trump himself paid movie extras to stand on the mezzanine at Trump Tower to hold signs and feign enthusiasm when he announced for president. I mean, what's next, projecting holographic images of people to bulk up the audience at campaign events?
Well, and a lot of this, to me, the bigger issue is even the smaller scale, like the local election. You'll see this on TV news sometimes. The protesters, you know, come down to, you know, protest something. And then when they're asked by the reporter about it, they clearly don't know anything about the issue. They're there to protest. Someone got them to come down. And, you know, it's not clear if they're paid or if, you know, lunch was offered. It doesn't feel authentic, and, you know, we see this kind of thing. We'll continue our conversation with Democratic political consultant Gary South, Edward Walker of UCLA, and James Rufus Corum, Los Angeles Times reporter, who's written about this. A recent piece, Paid Protesters, They're Real, and a Beverly Hills firm that hires them stands accused of extortion in a lawsuit. And we're going to talk when we come back with Susan in Los Feliz, who has worked for Crowds on Demand. We'll find out about her experience back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk with one of the candidates for Congress in Orange County in those pivotal races where Democrats are hoping to flip what have historically been GOP districts into the Democratic column. That's coming up in our second hour. Right now, we talk about how paid protesters are used, the types of campaigns that they're involved with, and how do we determine when we're seeing a group of people protesting, whether they're brought in to serve a special interest and compensated, or if it really represents grassroots Americans who care about the particular issue involved. Susan, in Los Feliz, I understand you've worked for Crowds on Demand. What was your experience?
I did. Hi. I was amused when I heard this topic come up. Basically, I was in school. This was a few years ago. And someone in school with me approached several of us that she knew through, you know, mutual class experiences and said, here's some work, because don't students need work? Yes. So we were hired to protest outside a major telecom company. It was a job. And so we worked, I want to say, 5 days a week. We had hours to show up on site, and we would protest. And, you know, for me, it was sort of a duality, because, you know, I was there to work, but it also seemed so reality TV. And I never knew whether or not the information we were being told was true or not, but I know that we were monitored by the person who hired or contracted Crowds on Demand. They would drive by, kind of give us a thumbs up. You know, we would get reports back whether or not we were being effective in what we were doing, or whether we looked like we were, you know, lagging or talking too much to each other.
Do you know who the client was in this case who hired Crowds on Demand?
I think I know who it is. It was never absolutely confirmed, but
okay.
I'm Googling to try to kind of pinpoint who the contractor was.
But you think you deduced who it was. And did they try and convince you as to the rightness of the cause for which you were protesting, or did they not bother with that?
No. There was signage provided. There was some printed matter that we were given that sort of supposedly supported the claim of the contractor. And, you know, people there were kind of crafty. There were actors in a group, you know, or people pursuing acting, I should say. And, you know, they were clever in their rhymes that they would make up on the spot. It was just entertaining to me. And I really, in the back of my mind, always felt like this is fodder for some comedy.
Yeah, I was going to say, definitely, it sounds like it borders on parody itself. And everybody, to your knowledge, there was paid. You were all compensated.
Oh, no, it was a compensated position.
The whole thing, okay.
Working for this company would come out and confront us. They would take our photographs. They would confront us saying, asking whether or not we were paid. Of course, people said that we were not. We were followed. And then, you know, it was just a madcap kind of enterprise.
Susan, I'm sorry, we're short on time, but what a fascinating experience. So Gary South, as a Democratic political consultant, should that then rightly make us skeptical of some of the, you know, the cause protests that we see out there?
Well, I think that we always have to approach protests with a bit of skepticism until we find out who's behind it and whether or not the people who are involved in it are genuinely committed to the cause. You know, in a campaign context, in a political campaign context, again, as I said up front, you know, campaigns have been paying people to do things for generations, but it's kind of self-defeating for a campaign to pay paid mercenaries to show up to bulk up the crowd or to attend a rally or to, you know, people a protest, because the purpose of a campaign, obviously, in the end, is to get votes. And if you can't find enough committed supporters of that candidate or that cause to people a protest, and you have to pay people who are completely uninvolved or uncommitted to do so, it tells you something about the validity and the power of that cause. So,
now, members of labor unions will often be, you know, go to Sacramento to protest. They'll be, you know, supporting or against particular legislation. And I've just always assumed those are people, you know, committed members of the union care about. But is there any compensation in some of those cases, or lodging or meals or things like that provided to people willing to do that?
Well, there is. And that's what I mentioned up front. You know, I've conducted many, many phone banks where we paid people in pizza. If you show up at 6 o'clock at night and spend 2 hours on the shift at a phone bank, we're going to bring in, you know, pizzas. So there's compensation of a sort involved in political activity like this. But again, what is new about this is the commercialization of this process. When a union essentially compensates members to go to Sacramento to protest or to lobby, those are members of the union. Those are not outside paid mercenaries who have no connection to the cause whatsoever. And this I think takes it up another step to the point where you're just basically picking people at random off the street or out of the phone book and paying them money to go stand someplace or attend something where they have absolutely no involvement whatsoever in the cause.
Professor Walker, just briefly, do you think that we're going to see growth in this as with social media, there's so much coverage of these kinds of protests?
You know, I do think we will see some growth of it in it. You know, I think, you know, we're now at a moment in which this term paid protesting has been weaponized, I would say, by the Trump administration, just like fake news has. And I think fake news has become, you know, an all-purpose tool for trying to attack the legitimacy of the free press, just as paid protesting is now an all-purpose tool for trying to attack freedom of assembly. And now we're actually seeing this White House propose new restrictions on public assemblies in Washington. There is a whole set of new rules that are in front of the National Park Service now that would drastically change the way that large demonstrations are treated. So I think we need to be, you know, thinking about this a lot, but not let this problem of distrust become much larger than it is today.
Professor, thank you for joining us. Gary South, thank you. James Rufus Corin of the LA Times, thanks. Suzanne in Hollywood says, I find this sinister and disturbing. It really diminishes the people who go out to protest something they're passionate about. You're listening to Air Talk.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Pleasure to be with you on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Whether you're listening on the KPCC app, kpcc.org, or 89.3, pleasure to have you with us. Just remind you that our in-depth coverage of the upcoming election is virtually everywhere that we are, here at 89.3, at kpcc.org, and laist.com. You'll see the voter game plan, all kinds of important information to help you be prepared for the election. And election night, my pleasure to work again with Libby Dankman. We'll be bringing you all the returns, but it starts with Nick Roman and NPR in the afternoon as the returns come in from the East Coast. We'll, of course, be closely following the House seats that are at stake. Democrats hoping to take the House of Representatives majority. We'll also follow what goes on with those contested Senate seats. We'll have that for you all afternoon. Then into the evening hours, Libby and I will take to the air at 8 o'clock and be interspersing local returns with NPR's coverage throughout the course of the evening. Again, that's right here on 89.3 and kpcc.org and the KPCC app. Well, to help prepare you for the upcoming election, it's our pleasure to talk with one of the candidates for the House of Representatives. Harley Ruda is seeking the seat that's been held for decades by Republican Dana Rohrabacher. It's a seat that takes a coastal swath from the Los Angeles County line in the north, Seal Beach, Huntington Beach, down to portions of Newport Beach, Laguna Beach, that coastal swath where Democrats think they have a chance of flipping that from a red seat to blue. Harley Ruda, thank you so much for joining us today on Air Talk.
Larry, thanks for having me on.
So first of all, let's introduce you to our listeners. Give us just the thumbnail sketch of your background. What have you done that's brought you to this point to run for Congress?
My background is business and law, and I had the good fortune of building companies up to approximately 10,000 people. But with the 2016 election, I decided it was time to take on the greater good of trying to serve my country by bringing sanity to Washington, D.C.
Now, you were registered as a Republican up until a couple years ago, right? So what led you to flip parties?
Well, I left in 1997.
Oh, that long ago. Okay.
Yeah, and then was an independent for 20 years. And the reason I left back in the 80s and 90s, that's back when Republicans believed in environmental stewardship, women's rights, civil rights, voting rights, bringing down the deficit and fiscal responsibility. And certainly that's not the case today. All of those issues seem to be on the back burner for most of the people in the Republican Party.
But no one typically holds up Democrats as being, controlled spenders either. So do you differentiate yourself from Democrats in terms of your fiscal approach, given that you were philosophically Republican 20 years ago?
I think I'm like most Americans who are between the 20-yard lines, who believe in socially progressive ideas but fiscal responsibility. And, yes, I believe the aggregate national deficit needs to come down and that the tax plan that was passed by the Republicans and Donald Trump certainly has made that worse.
What's your view on federal health care policy? Do you support continuation of the Affordable Care Act? Do you support a moving to what's been dubbed Medicare for All, a single-payer program at the federal level? What would you ultimately like to see?
Well, I'd like to see us get to open Medicare for All as a first step. And what I mean by that is often called the public option. And that would allow individuals, families, and businesses to purchase their medical insurance through Medicare. You'd still have, obviously, the private insurance market for those who would like to continue to get their insurance from that, from private insurers. In addition, I would reinstate the individual mandate. just as we expect people to have car insurance and home insurance, we should expect people who can afford health care insurance to purchase it. And then I would take the shackles off Medicare's ability to negotiate drug prices. That would have an impact on all of us, a positive impact on all of us, especially our seniors.
Now, for many primary care providers, they counterbalance the reimbursements they get for their Medicare patients with what they get from private insurance. So if they were inundated with a bunch of people taking that public option and getting the same reimbursement rates for Medicare, how would you deal with the availability of docs?
Well, you can phase this in. So you wouldn't just open it wide open. You would slowly bring the age down and open it up to wider involvement and make that option become to a larger group of individuals.
Okay, but you think you could control the cost of that? You don't think you'd have to increase reimbursements for those covered in that open Medicare program?
Well, what we know is that Medicare actually delivers quality health care services at approximately 65 cents on the dollar compared to the private insurance market. And they're doing that while serving users, healthcare users, that have a higher propensity for usage because of their age. So, in fact, we see it bringing down the prices overall effectively as you broaden the base of users within Medicare.
We're talking with Democratic candidate for Congress Harley Ruta. His district is one that's historically been about as Republican as any district in the country. It's coastal Orange County. But of course, like so much of Orange County, it's had demographic shifts. It's a district that voted for Hillary Clinton back in the last presidential election. There is still a Republican advantage in registration despite that. So, Harley Ruta, this is a district where clearly there's some significant antipathy toward President Trump, and you even saw 2 years ago with Hillary Clinton winning the district. Nonetheless, it's one that in registration is still philosophically Republican. So what are you saying to Republican voters who might not be President Trump supporters to attempt to get them to vote for you instead of Mr. Rohrabacher?
Really, we are talking about the issues. So when we look at the differences between Dana Rohrabacher and myself, Dana Rohrabacher has come out and said that homelessness is a lifestyle issue. While I recognize it's an issue where we want to get people back into our community and being producing citizens again, he has said that homeowners don't have to sell their homes to gays and lesbians, even though it's against the law in California and 21 other states. He does not believe in climate change, while I recognize it's one of the greatest issues, if not the greatest issue facing humanity. He supports offshore drilling. I don't. He supports the arming, training and arming of high school students to address gun violence potential, which I think is the most asinine thing I've heard a politician say in a really long time. And he certainly has a long relationship with Russia. But above all that, more than anything, he's simply not working. He's been there 30 years, and he has only passed 3 pieces of legislation, most recently 14 years ago. So people here are hungry for real representation, real support, and people, a person who will fight to protect, whether it's Medicare, whether it's Social Security, pre-existing conditions, show up and work on their behalf.
And, of course, in fairness to Mr. Rohrabacher, in recent years, I shouldn't say in recent years, but prior to that, when Democrats controlled, difficult for Republicans to get stuff through. We've invited Mr. Rohrabacher to join us on the program. We have invited him. We've not yet received a confirmation, and time is running out for him to join us on Air Talk to talk about his candidacy. But I just want to assure listeners that in all of these races, we invite both of the candidates to join us, and in some cases, they have declined. The same way with Mimi Walters, no response whatsoever from her office. That's in the neighboring congressional race where she's the Republican incumbent. If you have questions for a Democratic challenger, Harley Ruta, we're at 866-893 KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can also post a question on the Air Talk page at kpecc.org. So you mentioned that the environment is an area that you strongly support addressing climate change. If you were elected to the House, what federal policies would you support there?
I think the tremendous opportunity we have, and I know that's a strange way to start off a discussion on climate change, but we have to address climate change. So if we embrace the fact that those who address it are also creating new industries and new jobs for tomorrow in the clean tech, clean energy sectors, we can make Southern California the hallmark for the world in addressing climate change and creating those jobs right here. And I'm committed to doing that. And very tightly connected to this is also infrastructure, which has bipartisan support. And even though Donald Trump has had infrastructure week every week for 50 weeks and gotten nothing done, I'm hopeful with the new Congress we can work with members on both sides of the aisle and get infrastructure bill through.
If you end up being elected and if Democrats end up taking the House majority, how far do you think that the committees should go in investigating the Trump administration? Should there be a concerted effort to try and work towards impeachment? Or do you believe that that would, in the long run, damage the party to be very clear from the outset it's targeting the president?
Well, I think the discussion is premature. I think we need to make sure Mueller has sufficient time to do the breadth and depth that his investigation deserves. It's already resulted in over 30 indictments and convictions. So let's make sure we get through that. Let's see what that investigation reveals, and then let's decide what needs to be done, if anything.
All right. Harley Ruta, Democratic candidate for the 48th Congressional District in coastal Orange County. Mr. Ruta, you were critical of Congressman Rohrabacher for his small number of bills that are passed. What do you identify specifically in your district? Not necessarily, a national issue, but something you think if you were elected to Congress, you could take up that would be particular to your coastal Orange County district?
Great question. And let me cite, there's a one of the big issues we have in our district and in other parts of California are sober living homes. And these are homes that are set up to address those that have addictions. Some of them are excellent facilities. Some of them are not. And those that are not literally recruit addicts from around the country, bring them to California, provide less than satisfactory services for 6 months, take those benefits from the ACA, and then the term is curb them. They put them out on the curb. There is bipartisan legislation on the table from Congresswoman Judy Chu and Congresswoman Mimi Walters that addresses this issue. And I would certainly support that legislation. But to show you how desperate Dana Rohrabacher is, he submitted independent legislation, even though there was bipartisan bill waiting for him to add his name to it. He submitted his own. And, of course, he's the only one on that piece of legislation, and it's not going to go anywhere. But it provided political grandstanding for him other than doing the job he was elected to do.
We have Mark, who posted on our Air Talk page, the Orange County Register is endorsing Mr. Rohrabacher because, quote, while casting himself as a Democrat who puts country over party, Ruta unfortunately struggled in a meeting with our editorial board to articulate what he means by that, offering only his support of greater border security as backing for his claim. Mark, who posted on our page, is wondering what your response, Mr. Ruta, is to that Orange County Register endorsement and to the characterization of your meeting with the editorial board?
Yes, I met with him, and actually I was quite specific on areas that I would work across the aisle. And I did cite not just border security, but actually Senate Bill 744 that was passed in the Senate in 2013, which was comprehensive immigration reform. I also talked at length about the opportunity for infrastructure and addressing climate change. The fact that the Orange County Register decided to misstate that and use that as the sole reason for providing an endorsement for Rohrabacher after giving him a backhanded compliment in their support for him shows that it was a process that I think was flawed. And my understanding is they did not even interview Representative Rohrabacher. So it's a very interesting endorsement, to say the least.
Well, I hope we get a chance to talk with Congressman Rohrabacher again. I just want to assure listeners, we work very, very hard to try and get participation from both candidates in these races, but we're not going to refuse to interview one of the two candidates if the other doesn't come forward and say, you know, yes, we'll be on the program. So, we'll do the very best we can to get full representation. Mr. Ruta, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the time, Larry, and let's keep plugging ahead. We got, 6 days to go?
It's coming soon. I'm sure in many ways you'll be relieved to have your schedule decided one way or the other. That's Harley Ruta, Democratic candidate for California's 48th Congressional District, Coastal Orange County. Coming up on Air Talk, the use of drones to respond to 911 calls. Preliminarily, they're the calls that are in close proximity to the Chula Vista Police Department headquarters, but they're looking to expand out from there. It's all part of an FAA pilot program. But what do privacy advocates think of that increased use of law enforcement drones? We'll find out right after this brief break. The mid-sized city of Chula Vista, its police department, last week announced it's starting to use drones to respond to 911 calls for those areas that are within close proximity to the police headquarters. The drones are piloted from the roof of the police department. Now, Chula Vista is the second largest city in San Diego County, so it's a good-sized city to give this pilot program a shot to see how it works. Joining us to talk about the technology behind it and how it might aid law enforcement in responding to emergency calls is police captain at the Chula Vista PD, Phil Collum. Mr. Collum, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Larry. Pleasure to be here.
So describe how this works. I understand that because this is a pilot program approved by the FAA, you are limited in terms of where these 911 calls come from. Describe this.
That's correct. Since October 22nd, we've been utilizing drones to aid in our response to emergency calls. They're helping our first responders get the information they need to respond safely. But at the moment, this is under the FAA's authority and their integration pilot program. And the whole intent of this program is to research the possibility of the use of these drones in general municipal areas. So we are at the moment limited to essentially a one-mile radius around our launching location, which is currently our headquarters building here in the city of Chula Vista.
But I understand with the lens on the drone that you could actually get information from up to a couple miles away. It's just you can't physically take the drone beyond a mile.
That's right. The drone's physical position is controlled by a teleoperator and also limited by the boundaries of essentially a geographic space that is programmed in advance. But the drone is equipped with a camera on it. That is the whole intent of the drone, so that first responders can get visual information before entering a potentially dangerous scene. That camera is capable of zooming in between a half mile and to a mile visibility further.
Now, in some cases, of course, police are going to send out a helicopter for specific types of 911 calls. Would the drone be dispatched at the discretion of the dispatcher, or is this something that within that 1 to 2 miles, a drone is going to go out on almost every call?
No, the drones are under the control of sworn police officers, actually, that are trained pilots and certified under the FAA's programs. So they are the ones that, just like our police officers in the field, can respond to calls for service. That response can be requested by other officers in the field. It could be requested by a police dispatcher, or it could be initiated by the drone operator, him or herself, by observing calls that are pending in the queue to be dispatched. They're looking for emergency calls, but they are specifically responding to calls only. They're not being used for proactive aerial flights or surveillance or anything of that.
I guess what I'm getting at is because it's potentially, you know, much cheaper to dispatch a drone than a helicopter, is it likely you would use drones in a higher percentage of 911 calls than you would use a helicopter?
Yes, Larry, undoubtedly. In fact, in the first 3 days of this pilot program, we found that our drone was used 29 times. That's far more frequently than we have the capacity to utilize our regional resources and actually use a full manned helicopter platform, a much more, certainly expensive and more difficult platform to launch and recover.
Also joining us on the program, we welcome back Jesse Geip, who is Senior Economic Development Manager for the San Diego Economic Development Corporation. They've partnered with the cities of San Diego and Chula Vista. This is part of a joint application with the FAA's Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration Pilot Program. Mr. Geip, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be back.
So let's talk about what sorts of information is being gathered from Chula Vista and San Diego's use of drones. What are some of the questions that these agencies and the FAA are hoping to answer?
Sure. So like a lot of things, you know, it's people, process, and technology. There's a technology element to what Chula Vista is looking to do, and there's some phenomenal corporate partners that are working with them to actually supply the drone, but you know, there's questions the FAA has about the battery life of that drone, the range, how it performs in different weather conditions, and that's all information that's being collected. There's also the process. So what is the procedure that the city of Chula Vista and the police department is implementing to ensure that the aircraft is safe, that it's flying with awareness of the airspace, so that if there are other emergency aircraft or low-flying objects, that drone is not going to be impacted by them or impact them. So there's a variety of different elements to this project. And, of course, also very important to the FAA is the public outreach component of what we're doing through all of the IPP programs. And so the Chula Vista Police Department has been incredibly proactive over the last several years, even predating IPP, in engaging the community, both the public and other organizations like the ACLU, in this program to understand both the kind of the privacy and regulatory concerns of operating a program like this. And that's all part of the general acceptance of this technology. So it's for the FAA, you know, you'll hear them say over and over again, it's all about safety. And that safety is really a part of that, you know, people, process, technology. And so we're really in the crawl phase of this program, but you know, we're looking to continue to advance into increasingly complex operations.
We're talking with Jesse Geip of the San Diego Economic Development Corporation. Also with us is Hamid Khan, who's an organizer with Stop LAPD Spying Coalition. Sir, thank you for joining us. What are your concerns about the use of drones?
Well, thank you. Thanks for the invite, Larry. I think I just want to go back to the earlier question that you were asking the captain from Chula Vista Police Department, which in essence, if we were to reframe that, would point us to what mission creep looks like. And typically, this is what we have seen, that how the original intent expands over time as well. We can have all the policies that we want to, but policies that adapt to the needs of local law enforcement agencies. So I think that's one of the biggest concerns that we have, that how mission creep and the expansion of the program over time sets in.
What would be a specific example? For example, are you okay with this being used only in response to 911 calls, or do you even have concerns about it being used in some of those cases?
I mean, we have concerns about the use by law enforcement, period, about this kind of tactical technology. And I'll give you a couple examples that the state of North Dakota, just a couple of years ago, I mean, they started using drones, but then the state passed a law where police drones can now carry non-lethal weapons, which would be tear gas and rubber bullets, and various other forms of non-lethal weapons. We had another instance last year where the state of Connecticut, with their House Bill 7260, was actively debating to arm these police drones with lethal weapons as well, so with bullets and bombs and tear gas. So I think it's we have to look at that when we are having these conversations, that what is the potential in the future for these kind of tactical technologies to cause harm. The original intent for the drone has been a surveillance and a weapon delivery platform. So then we also have to incorporate those into the much larger architecture of surveillance. I mean, right now, Axon, which makes body cameras, and DJI, the manufacturers of most of these drones, are actively looking as drones using real-time facial recognition technology. Now, how that would impact communities, how that would impact people on the ground. I think, secondly, we also have to, and which we forget most of the time in these conversations, is just the trauma, the psychological trauma we've had. Communities, I live in Los Angeles, I'm in Los Angeles County, South Central Los Angeles, the ghetto bird, helicopters, how these helicopters and how these have been used really, and which can bring a lot of trauma to the community. So I think we have to really ground ourselves and frame this in the larger context of what is the potential to cause harm rather than getting stuck in just the voluntary benefit.
Yes, I wondered, though, if helicopters are kind of a good model here, because you don't typically, very rare, there was a recent LAPD case of someone firing from a helicopter. Generally, that's not in departmental policy. So if you had drones that are not equipped with either lethal or non-lethal weapons, and it doesn't go down that slippery slope, as you put it, would you be okay with that?
No, like I said, that we are not looking at it, what purpose it serves now. I think we have to look at it both historically and currently, that how mission creep happens over time, how technologies adapt. We have a clear example of SWAT, that how this was used initially as a response to high sensitive situations like hostage and all that. But now we are seeing that SWAT's being used for low-level drug offenses. And, you know, we've seen a lot of counterterrorism programs like suspicious activity reporting and others, which have been expanded into everyday policing. So, Larry, while, I mean, I think the intent may be there to prevent, to provide service at a much faster pace. But I was looking at the report that they're saying the time it's going to take is going to go from 5 to 6 minutes to 2 minutes. Okay, so we cut back 3 minutes. But then when we know and we have seen how these operations expand into various other areas, I think knowingly we can't put blinders on ourselves and accept that, okay, well, you know, this is not going to happen in this instance.
Okay, Phil Collum of Chula Vista Police Department, you want to respond to the slippery slope concern here?
Sure, absolutely. And Mr. Khan is raising some very interesting points. What we're really focused on is community safety here. That's our top priority. We're using this tool as a means to get officers onto the scene when called by our public as quickly as possible, even if that's just virtually on scene, so that they can provide some critical safety information to other responding officers. That not only helps our officers stay safe, but in the ever-increasingly complex world of police operations, it helps the community to stay safe by informing our officers before they ever round the corner of what is potentially a dangerous scene. In addition, though, our police department, in cooperation with the City of San Diego and others, have worked incredibly hard over the course of the last 3 years. Where we are today with the launch of this drone program is just another stage in our sort of crawl, walk, run methodology of this potential technological platform. And we are looking at we have developed policies that have been informed by information that we've been provided by the ACLU and other community stakeholders. We've held 13 different community meetings and forums, received a lot of input, and we are continuing that. We're actually working on a public website to help inform our public as to when and why we're using this technology. That website would likely include information like flight data, but it would not include video, by the way. We're also developing a public working group consisting of members of our community, the ACLU, and other stakeholders to help oversee operations with the use of this technology to help guide our local government's use in the future.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Police Captain Phil Collum, Chula Vista Police Department. Once again, they started last week with a pilot program, response to 911 calls that are within a 1 mile vicinity of the police headquarters. Sworn officers pilot the drones after receiving specialized training from the roof of the police headquarters. And this part of a pilot project with the City of San Diego and the FAA. And the San Diego Economic Development Corporation. Our thanks to Jesse Geip from that organization and Hamid Khan, also joining us from the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. So coming up, we're going to have a little fun for Halloween today. I know, you know, some places, like here at KPCC, employees are in costume. Not me, I'm dressed as a talk show host, but there are some great costumes that are in the halls here at KPCC. And I want to open up the phones and hear from you. What is the most head-scratching costume you've worn that you thought people would get and they didn't, and that you had to explain? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Or what was the most embarrassing incident? Someone you knew, you work with a family member, someone at a party wore a costume you should have gotten, you didn't get it, and felt like you had egg on your face. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Obtuse costumes. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm always already looking at the fun people don't get Halloween costumes. I look forward to your sharing the costume that you wore that you thought would be so witty or culturally communicative, and people didn't get it. 866-893-KPCC. 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I remember when my son, for Halloween several years ago, I think he was in middle school, and he dressed up as a delegate to a political convention. And so he's dressed in his suit and tie, and he's holding up one of those things, that, you know, the signs that they hold up at the political convention. Of course, no one got it. Yo, you businessman, you lawyer, what? So, you know, sometimes it just doesn't connect. It's not obvious what you're trying to say with the costume. 866-893-KPCC. Lucy in Laguna Beach, what costume did you wear that you thought was quite creative and no one understood?
When I was in middle school, I dressed up like a garden gnome and went as Noam Chomsky.
Noam Chomsky. Oh, that's great.
I carried around some of his books, and none of my classmates got them.
No one got that. Wow.
No one got it.
All right. Noam Chomsky, the linguist and left political activist, as well as written on so many different political topics. Lucy, where were you going to school at the time?
I was in Chicago, actually. It was just a middle school, city middle school.
All right. I can say some neighborhoods, maybe people would get, particularly progressive neighborhoods, would get the Noam Chomsky reference. Lucy, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Star in Santa Monica, which costume did you wear that just fell flat and no one understood?
It was a black teddy over new tights and leotard. I was in the back of the hall. The guy in the front of the hall, he just took up notice. As soon as he finished his calling, this was a square dance. As soon as he finished calling, he raced to the back to check me out, and his jaw dropped because I wasn't nude underneath the black teddy.
So that was, yeah, and what were you going as?
Just, you know, you just put a costume on.
Okay.
The funny part was that he thought I was new.
Yeah. Yeah. And so came running to your aid. Star, thank you. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brian in Brea. I love this one. So, Brian, which costume fell flat?
Well, I thought it was very witty. I had a white T-shirt, and I painted the letter C on my T-shirt, and it was a color red, and I was at church, a church outing, and no one could figure out what it was.
Red C, and no one got it, huh?
Nobody got it. I thought it would be obvious.
Yeah, yeah. Were you able to part the Red Sea? All right, Brian and Brea, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Nicole in Hollywood said two coworkers of mine went, one dressed as a hippie, another dressed as a mime. They were peace and quiet. That's creative. 866-893-KPCC. Robin Mid-Wilshire says, I dressed as a no parking street sweeping sign. I had a hat that said your worst nightmare, a shirt that said no parking, and no one got it. Let's see. Andrew in Santa Monica. Andrew, what costume did you try that didn't connect?
Well, this was before the Harry Potter movies came out. I dressed as Harry Potter, but nobody knew what he was supposed to look like. So I spent all night basically telling people, I'm Harry Potter, damn it.
So how close did you get to how Harry looked in the films?
Probably not at all. I did get the round glasses, and I had the lightning bolt on my forehead.
That's so funny. You should have saved that costume. But Andrew in Santa Monica, 866-893-KPECC, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Clyde in Capistrano Beach, your costume that no one understood.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Clyde.
Yeah, so last year I dressed up as Einstein because I had long hair at the time and my hair kind of looks like Einstein. And all I did is put on a white T-shirt with suspenders, and I drew the letter E equals MC squared on the shirt. And people couldn't figure out who I was, and I was quite surprised about that. So eventually I started asking kids, look, you get an extra piece of candy if you can figure out who I am. And all night long, nobody could figure it out. Adults couldn't even figure it out. And finally, they were texting each other and going on their phones to Google to research who might have said E equals MC squared. It was pretty funny.
And that's a little disappointing, I have to say, Clyde, because obviously when you see E equals MC squared, immediately Einstein comes to mind. I would think you wouldn't even have to have anything else. Just the equation itself would be enough. But, wow, so you totally struck out with that. If you'd been in the neighborhood of Caltech, that would...
People kept coming back and trying to, get the right answer to the million-dollar question.
All right, Clyde, thanks. 866-893-KPCC. Aaron in Pasadena, you'd probably get the E equals MC squared, but what costume of yours didn't hit the mark?
I was wearing a tuxedo, and I also put on a name tag on it that said, sorry. And it was supposed to be a formal apology.
Formal apology. All right. Very good. Anyone get it?
No, I knew I had to explain it to everyone, but it is what it is.
They laughed, I'm sure, after you told them. So that's Aaron, thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Which costume did you wear, maybe to work, to a party, to school, that you thought was so witty, was so, on the mark, and people just scratched their heads, couldn't figure it out? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. Norma in Lakewood said, my best costume ever. I cut up, painted a cardboard box to look like Snoopy's doghouse. I cut a hole in it for my head so I could wear a tight little Snoopy doll to my head. I was Snoopy's doghouse. How did people not get that? 866-893-KPECC. Norma also said that she loves those concept costumes like formal apology that we just heard from Aaron. Genevieve said, when my son was in middle school, he dressed up as Kim Jong-un, military attire, coiffed hair, etc. Everybody thought he was the Gangnam Style artist. He even wore a picture of Kim Jong-un pinned to his chest, and nobody still got it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Karen, downtown Los Angeles, your costume that went awry.
Okay, I was the large intestines. I was attending a party at the Pyramid Club in New York City, East Village.
Yeah.
Back in the 80s. And yeah, we had to come dressed as a body part. So
a body part, okay.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not going to be a body part. I'm going to be an organ.
An internal organ, yeah.
Yes. So, and yeah, it was like, I had like an old orange sweater and the sweater had like little, you know, it was a large knit sweater, so I was able to put like Cheetos in the little holes. The food, marshmallows, things that you would find in the large intestine. And, it was a lot of fun, but no one could figure it out.
And I'm sorry, listeners, as we get close to lunch, hearing about the large intestine call, but no one got it at the Pyramid Club, Karen?
No, they did not understand it. I had to explain it.
All right. Thanks, Karen. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. I guarantee that's the only time you're going to hear about a Halloween costume as a large intestine anywhere on radio. We'll have more costumes that missed the mark, you thought were witty or pointed, that no one seemed to understand, left them scratching their heads. 866-893-5722. Back with more on this Halloween on Air Talk. In preparing for our conversation about Halloween costumes, where the concept didn't connect, there's some very funny examples offline. If you have any time today you're trying to kill, you might just check for Halloween costumes that nobody gets. And there's some very funny ones. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Yvonne writes on the page, I'm currently dressed up right here with a nun's headpiece, a habit, carrying a small briefcase at work. And I have to keep explaining, I am none of your business. That's Yvonne, 866-893-KPECC. Let's see. We have Michelle in downtown Los Angeles. Michelle, what costume of yours didn't work?
Hi. So we were doing a Proposition 8 vampire. This is the gay marriage.
Ban on same-sex marriage. Yeah.
Yes. So it was a yes on 8 vampire. And our idea was that we were, you know, going to be sucking the blood from human rights. So I carried around a little baby that said human rights. And we had printed out these papers that looked like the yes on 8 signs. And we made outfits out of them. And we thought they were amazing. And we went out in West Hollywood. And some people looked at us like we were crazy. And they were like, boo, because, you know, West Hollywood is a big gay community.
Yeah.
And some people got it and they were like, yay, but it was confusing, I guess. And we were so excited to give our message and it just didn't always work.
Didn't quite work. And you would think in West Hollywood, where you're parroting supporters of Prop 8, that would have been an ideal audience, but they didn't get it, at least a lot of them. All right, Michelle, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Karen in Mission Viejo says, I went with a bunch of my name is stickers and a bunch of different names written in the blank. The costume was identity thief, but no one got it. Elena Shatkin, food editor of LAist, who's been with us very recently on Air Talk, said, I went as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, obvious mashup there of RBG and Darth Vader. And I have pictures to prove it, but nobody really got it because I didn't wear a Darth Vader mask. All right. But, you know, one of the things Elena points out is this year that's gone viral. Some kid did it, and that's become a very popular social media image from Halloween is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg mashup. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Claudia in Mar Vista, what costume did you try? Didn't work.
Well, I was working as a book editor at the time, so I dressed up in sort of a traditional toga that I covered with proofreaders marks. I don't know if your readers or your listeners will be familiar with this term, errata, the goddess of bad spelling.
That's funny.
Latin term for
print. For printed errors, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And so did you go to a gathering of fellow editors?
I did. And it was a big hit once I explained it. But
yes,
the entire evening explaining the costume.
I'm sure. Hey, Claudia, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Andrew, in Costa Mesa, you and your wife dressed up. What was the costume that you two used?
Yeah, we tried to dress up as a Mr. and Mrs. Fantastic Fox from the Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
Fantastic Mr. Fox. And it was the same time that the YouTube video, What Did the Fox Say, had come out. We hadn't seen the video. So all night long, everybody was drinking, asking us, What did the fox say? What did
the fox say? No idea. So it kind of worked, but not in the way you intended.
Yeah, it was pretty fun, but it was more fun when someone finally showed us the video, but we had no idea.
How funny. That's a whole subset of costumes that don't connect when you're tapping into something you didn't even know was out there as you did. Thanks, Andrew. 866-893-KPECC, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Rod in La Crescenta, what costume of yours didn't work?
Back in 09, I was in New Orleans, and I kind of made a Mylar balloon out of foil and had a sign that said my dad made me do it. I was Balloon Boy, if you remember him.
Oh, yeah. This was where it was a hoax, right? Because the kid wasn't actually in it?
Exactly, yeah.
That's right. I vaguely remember there was like this national concern. All the news channels go to it because the father claimed that the kid had gone up in the balloon and he was floating on his own. So how many people got your Balloon Boy costume?
Well, interestingly enough, I was walking on Bourbon Street and every now and then I get a couple laughs, but no one really had any idea what was going on.
All right, Rod. With any regrets or you feel it was still worth it because you liked the costume?
Oh, I loved it.
All right. 866-893-KPCC. I mean, that's the other way to look at it, even if other people don't get it. If you've made yourself happy, if you've made yourself laugh, then that's even more important. Mike in East Los Angeles, your costume.
Larry, I was in Halloween in West Hollywood, and I thought I was real clever and had this really sparkly vest on. And a bunch of 20-year-olds walked up to me, and I asked what they were wearing, and they asked what I was wearing. I said, oh, I'm Liza Minnelli's next gay husband. And they looked at each other, looked at me, and said, who's Liza Minnelli?
Oh, no. All right. Mike. All right. 866-893-KPECC. Yeah, sometimes the generation gap comes out in those. Maria, in Venice, you have a costume that went back to Y2K?
Yes. It was 1999, and we dressed in all black with tinfoil antenna, and we were Y2K bugs.
And no one got it?
But they loved it once they did.
Yeah, that's it. And that's still a hit, right? If once they know what you are, they end up laughing. Let's see. Richard in Valley Village, your costume that wasn't understood.
I dressed up as a character in a movie. The character was played by Fred Ward. The movie was Cast a Deadly Spell. I went to a Halloween party. The first person who asked me what I was dressed as happened to be the guy who had written the movie, Joe Forney.
You've got to be kidding.
No. Joe and I have actually been friends ever since. But, I'm not kidding.
What a great story for us to end on. And he didn't get it, the screenwriter of the film where you were playing the lead character. Richard, thanks so much. You can share some of your favorite stories on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, costumes, where you thought you had a great concept and no one else understood what you were. Have a wonderful rest of your Halloween, a very safe time, and hope it's a fun time for you and your family members. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next AirTalk on KPCC. PCC Fresh Air with Terry is next.